Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Center for Science and Culture. I'm Robert Crowther, and joining me today in the Center's Seattle office is biologist, author, provocateur, intelligent design proponent, all-around good guy, Jonathan Wells. Is that a pretty good introduction or what?
Thank you, Rob. Very kind of you.
We'll talk just a minute about your latest book, Zombie Science, a little bit later in the podcast, but I wanted to sort of focus on your education and background, which people may know a little bit about, or they might be surprised by some of it, especially your times at UC Berkeley. Most people know Berkeley is a hotbed of liberalism. It has been since you were probably originally there, and students seem to continually be protesting something. So how does someone get an education at Berkeley?
Well, I'd actually like to back up a little bit. I started out as an undergraduate at Princeton.
Other side of the country.
Other side of the country in 1960. And at Princeton, I majored in geology. Well, geology in those days was very exciting, because there was a huge controversy over drifting continents. If you look at the eastern contour of the Americas and the western contour of Europe and Africa, they kind of match. And in the early 20th century, Alfred Wegener had proposed that the continents used to be together and then eventually drifted apart. Well, a lot of people didn't accept that. Princeton was right at the heart of the controversy because Princeton geologists provided much of the evidence that eventually resolved the controversy. So I was right in the thick of that. But at the time, I was not aware of any controversy over evolution. As far as I knew, all my professors accepted Darwin's theory of evolution, and that was that. Well, in my junior year, although I was doing well academically, I decided to drop out to find myself, as we said in those days. Mm-hmm. Well, I found myself eligible for the draft. I drove a cab for a while because it was the only job I could get, and then I got drafted into the U.S. Army. I spent 2 years on active duty until 1966. Then I was separated to reserve status. In those days, the obligation was actually for 6 years, 2 years active and 4 on reserve. Well, by then, the Vietnam War had escalated, and I had become an opponent of it, verbally. Well, Berkeley then was a hotbed of anti-war activism,
right.
So I transferred to Berkeley in 67. Unfortunately, I also got a letter from the Army saying I had to come back as a reservist. So here I was in this hotbed of anti-war sentiment with a letter ordering me to report for Army reserve duty.
Wow.
And I politely refused, and they didn't like that. I ended up getting arrested and spending a year and a half in prison.
Boy, they were polite too.
Actually, the Army prison people were not bad. Much better, I think, than a state prison. So when I returned to Berkeley after prison, it had become quite violent. Some far-left radicals had tried to take over a piece of university property and turn it into what it was essentially a homeless camp. They called it People's Park. And their violence, that is the violence of the radicals, so repelled me that when I graduated, I moved to Northern California. I headed for the hills. I built a cabin in the woods and lived there for a year, worked weekends in a nearby town.
So you didn't finish your education at Berkeley at that point. You just left.
I finished my undergraduate education.
Your undergrad.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
We did not have a graduation ceremony because there was too much tear gas in the air. So, but I officially graduated in 1970. So there I was in the mountains in a cabin, mostly by myself. And although up until that point, I had always assumed that the world around me was a product of unguided evolution, as I looked at the plants and animals I was surrounded by, I decided that could not be an accident. These things were there, that they were purposefully designed. I started meditating and praying and reading the Bible, got interested in theology, and ended up back in New York studying theology. But I was still fascinated by this theory of evolution that I had grown up with. And so I spent several days a week at the Columbia University Biology Library studying evolution while I was studying theology. I went from there to Yale University to get a PhD in theology, but continued my interest in evolution and did my PhD dissertation research on the 19th century controversies over evolution in theology. And the focus of my research was Charles Hodge, a Princeton theologian who criticized Darwinism on two grounds. One, it did not have enough evidence. And two, Darwin's theory denied design. And for Hodge, that was tantamount to atheism. So I finished that, finished my Yale PhD with a lot of knowledge about the 19th century controversies, worked for a couple of years in New York, but decided I needed to learn more about the biological aspects of the controversy. So I decided to go back to school in biology.
And you went back to?
Well, I started out applying to several schools in 1988. I was rejected by all of them and had to try again in 1989, which I did. In 1989, I was accepted to several and chose to go to Berkeley.
Wow. So you were first at Princeton, then Berkeley, then the Army, and then Yale. And
well,
now
back to Berkeley after the Army.
Oh, yeah, right. Back to Berkeley.
Yeah. And then
you bounced around a little bit with your education.
Around Columbia.
That's a well-rounded education.
Well, thank you. That's a very kind way to put it.
So you find yourself back at Berkeley, and this is the early 90s now?
It's the late 80s.
Late 80s. And your focus is on evolution, Darwinian evolution. And what was your specific, what was your actual degree in? Is it just in biology or is it in molecular biology or?
Well, officially it's molecular biology, but my specialty was embryology, in fact, embryology and evolution. When I applied to Berkeley in 89, I included in my admissions essay the fact that I did not believe DNA carries a program for embryo development. I didn't put this in the essay, but that also meant I believed DNA mutations could not provide the raw materials for evolution. So I was skeptical of evolution on that score. But there were professors at Berkeley in biology who agreed with me that DNA did not contain a program for development. I'm not kidding. It was quite a diverse department in those days. And I'm sure that helped me get in. So I started in 1989. My focus was cell and developmental biology, specifically frog embryos. And I got a very good education at Berkeley. My undergraduate days, years before, were marked by, you know, prison and tear gas and things like that.
Right.
My graduate studies from 1989 to 1994 were very rigorous and intense, and I learned an awful lot. I really got a good education there. I think if you were to ask my Berkeley professors at this point, they would say, I failed to learn anything. But in fact, I learned a lot.
Yeah.
And the more I learned, the more skeptical I became of Darwin's theory.
Which is often the case. People tend to think in their own area, like you did. You had, you know, questions about DNA and development. And you're so focused on that, you just assume, well, in these other areas, Darwinian evolution must be, you know, it stands up. All the scientists believe it in every other discipline, so that must be right. And then once you broaden out, you find out that maybe that's not the case.
Quite right. In fact, one of the professors at Berkeley when I was there, a cell biologist, was talking to Philip Johnson at one point. Philip Johnson wrote the book Darwin on Trial, which I read when I was a grad student there. And Philip said to this fellow, well, it seems that you accept evolution in every area except your own, which is cell biology. You know it doesn't work there. And he said, yes, it works everywhere else. And Phil said, well, the only thing you know is cell biology. You don't know about all these other fields. In fact, it has problems everywhere we look. And that's what I learned, among other things, when I was at Berkeley.
Interesting. So did that begin to influence or inspire your career trajectory as an author, writing about what you have called the icons of evolution?
Absolutely. In fact, the first icon I wrote about was embryos, because I was working with them on a daily basis. I could look at the embryos and look at the textbook pictures and realize that there was a complete disconnect. So I wrote an article about that for the American biology teacher in 1998. Around the same time, I started learning about problems with the classic peppered moth story. that used photographs of light and dark moths on tree trunks as evidence for natural selection. Well, I learned that those moths don't normally rest on tree trunks and that the photos had been staged. So I also wrote about that in 1998. Those were my first two icons.
And that led to the book, Icons of Evolution.
Yes, which was published in 2000.
And now here we are in 2017, and you have another new book, Zombie Science, which is a continuation on a theme.
Yes, it is. By zombie science, I mean materialistic philosophy masquerading as empirical science. Science, when it's done right, I'm speaking as a scientist, is a search for truth by testing hypotheses against the evidence. But another definition of science that has become prominent in the last few decades is the search for natural explanations for everything. And those explanations are promoted even when they don't fit the evidence. And that's what I call zombie science. It's the telling of materialistic stories even when they don't fit the evidence. And I've discovered that the icons I wrote about in 2000 are pretty much still with us. So they're basically materialistic stories masquerading as empirical science. And that's what's being taught to our students, our children. There were some improvements after 2000. Some textbooks removed some of the icons, or they represented them more accurately. I mean, some of the icons are real evidence. The pictures of the Archaeopteryx fossil, for example, that's a real fossil. But the textbooks back then often represented it as the ancestor of modern birds, and no paleontologist really believes that anymore. And in fact, they didn't in 2000 even. But some of the icons disappeared for a while and have come back. For example, drawings of vertebrate embryos made by Darwin's contemporary in the 1860s supposedly showed that we look very much like little fish as embryos. Well, those drawings were faked. A lot of textbooks removed them after I pointed that out in 2000, but now they're back in some of them. For example, I have a textbook with a copyright date of 2013 that has those original 1860 drawings in it with the same claim.
And they're still as false, still as much fake news as they were before.
That's right. In fact, in that particular case, they were known to be fake soon after they were made, and yet they've been in the textbooks ever since.
Well, I'm glad you were able to talk with us a little bit about your background, your educational efforts and things, and also a little bit about Zombie Science. That is your latest book, Zombie Science, More Icons of Evolution. You can find out more about that at iconsofevolution.com. That site actually details a lot of your work, not just on this book, but all your other books. And there's an archive of articles and journal pieces that you've written and other things. So if people want to know about your books and about you, best place to get that information is at iconsofevolution.com. That's iconsofevolution.com. Jonathan, thanks for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure, Rob.
For more podcasts like this one, be sure to visit idthefuture.com. That's idthefuture.com. I'm Robert Crowther for the Center for Science and Culture. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.